How's that for an entrance? Good evening. My name is Robert Hartwell, and on behalf of the San Francisco Opera, I'd like to welcome you to what promises to be a great evening. My cat is named Puccini. And like the composer, my cat is not particularly intellectual and suffers from an inclination toward laziness. Giacomo Antonio Michele Seconda Maria Puccini wrote 12 operas over the course of his career, an astonishing 7 of which are still regularly performed today. And really, where would we be without Bohème, Tosca, and Butterfly? And indeed, tonight's opera, La Bohème, is among the most widely performed of all operas, and no wonder. It's approachable, it's disarming, it's refreshingly free of pharaohs and poison cups and over-the-top villains. In fact, there are no villains of any kind. Instead, we have a real story populated by real people that seemingly moves in real time. A lean and compelling tale of love, loss, and the passing of youthful innocence, all expressed in music of exceptional beauty and power. But before I launch into Bohème, I'd like to linger for a moment on bohemianism. What exactly is it, and where did it come from? Bohemian was a term that the French applied incorrectly to the wandering Romani people, more widely known as gypsies. The French had mistakenly thought that the Romani people originated in Central Europe, Bohemia, Bohemians. We know now from DNA evidence that they actually trace their roots back to India. But Bohemian soon became a metaphor for young, carefree, and invariably poor artistic types living outside the lines of conventional society and conventional morality. And as with our opera tonight, it was particularly associated with 19th century Paris and the Latin Quarter. And I think a little bit like the cowboy mythology of the American West, the bohemian existence still exerts a kind of romantic appeal, doesn't it? I mean, there we are, stuck in rush hour traffic, burdened by cares and responsibilities. Who among us at least once hasn't thought, I'm ready to give all this up and become a writer or artist or what have you? But as I quickly remind myself before I put everything I own on Craigslist, is that A, I have no talent, and B, it's a fiction scrubbed of unpleasant realities. Take, for example, the bohemian world of our opera tonight, 19th century Paris. In truth, it meant living in squalid conditions that were rife with hunger and disease, or in other words, enduring hardships that could even kill, as we will have occasion to be reminded tonight. Puccini's opera is based on a play by Henri Murger entitled Scènes de la vie de Bohème, Scenes from the Bohemian Life. And Murger so ably captured this bohemian life because he had walked the walk. His play is based on his own experiences as a desperately poor writer, experiences that so compromised his health that he would ultimately die penniless in a Paris hospital at the age of 38. It wasn't until almost 50 years later that Puccini turned that play into an opera, but not without some accompanying real-life drama. The composer Ruggero Leoncavallo had already started setting Murger's play when Puccini decided to take it up. Now, as an aside here, Puccini had already developed a bad habit of only getting interested in a story after somebody else had started on it. In any case, Leoncavallo, when he heard about this, insisted that Puccini desist. After all, he had started his Bohème first. Well, Piccinni, instead of yielding, rather threw down the gauntlet. He said, "You compose yours, I'll compose mine, and we'll let the public decide." And the public has decided. Here we are in 2025 talking about Puccini's Bohème and Leoncavallo's Consigned to the Dustbin of Time. La Bohème, like the play, has no real story, but rather is a series of vignettes, episodes in the life of a poor seamstress and her artistic friends. Or as somebody summarized it, boy meets girl, boy loses girl, boy and girl are reunited at the end. But perhaps the real protagonists here are not our starving artists, but rather our youth, love, and Paris. And I think we can agree there's nothing wrong with any of those things. The 1896 premiere was conducted by none other than the legendary Arturo Toscanini. The two great musicians, Puccini and Toscanini, enjoyed what we might call a tumultuous friendship, a friendship punctuated by frequent periods where they were not talking to each other, as illustrated by a favorite story of mine. Every Christmas, Puccini enlisted a local baker to send out a panettone, a traditional Christmas pastry, to his friends for the holiday. Now, one Christmas, the baker sent a panettone to Toscanini, not realizing that Puccini and Toscanini were in one of their frequent feuds. When Puccini heard about this, he flew into a rage and fired off a telegram. It said, "Panettone sent by mistake, Puccini." The next day he received his reply, "Panettone eaten by mistake, Toscanini." You gotta love these guys. So why is this work still so popular 29 years after its premiere? Or put another way, what makes it great? Well, I think in general, it is a deceptively sophisticated work. In spite of that surface approachability, the more you look, the more there is to see, and in my view, that's one of the barometers of a masterpiece. But tonight, I want to draw your attention to four things in particular. First, Puccini's eye for the stage and his unerring sense of theatrical timing. Two, the balance and subtle craftsmanship that he exhibits throughout. Three, the quality of the libretto. The libretto is the story, with its fusion of romanticism and realism. And four, Puccini's magnificent and, in my view, unrivaled melodic gift. We see Puccini's eye for the stage as soon as the curtain goes up. We meet our four housemates, starving artists all. They're clowning around, they're trying to stay warm, they thwart the landlord out of the overdue rent. It all feels delightfully spontaneous and improvisational. But this feeling of effortlessness is actually an illusion. This is a very difficult effect to achieve. And by the way, the conversational style of this scene with its declamatory chatter was something completely new to the opera world in 1896. Now, halfway through Act One, our drama turns serious. Our poet Rodolfo is home alone working when his neighbor Mimi knocks on the door because her candle has gone out. She almost immediately faints because she is ill with consumption, which we know today as pulmonary tuberculosis, one of the great killers of the 19th century. And by the way, it was called consumption because sufferers experienced extreme weight loss as if their body were being consumed. But I'd like to just drill down here and take a quick look at the sociological implications of our story. One gets the sense that the four young men are playing at this bohemian existence, and at some point will go on to a life of comfort and respectability. But not Mimi. Her plight is another matter altogether. She's a seamstress, presumably in a factory, one of the multitudes trapped in the nightmare of the Industrial Revolution, living in squalid conditions that were vectors for diseases like tuberculosis. And just to remind us of how bad those things were, for a child born into one of those industrial worker families in, say, Birmingham or Manchester, a life expectancy of 15. In any case, back to our story. Mimi is revived, and now we are treated to Puccini's magnificent melodic gift as he delivers three consecutive showstoppers. These deservedly famous arias also serve structural functions. They give us needed character development, but also, and more importantly, they introduce us to the themes that will accompany our character for the remainder of the opera. And typical of Puccini, he does it quickly and in an orderly fashion. He sings, she sings, they sing, curtain falls. So first, our poet Rodolfo. Now, to say this aria is famous is like saying oceans have some water in them. As we speak, I predict it is playing in the background of every Italian restaurant on the planet. But I think it's a testament to its greatness that that familiarity has in no way diminished its appeal. But notice, he starts off quietly as he touches her hand, "Che gelida manina," how cold your hand is. And I want you to notice it's in three clearly delineated sections, with each one becoming more animated than the one before. And now it's Mimi's turn. She also starts off quietly. She also becomes more animated. But here, I want to draw your attention to the subtle literary quality of the libretto. She tells us she's a seamstress who sews flowers that have no scent. A metaphor, I think, for a life without love. And this literary quality is no accident. It's the work of two distinguished men of letters, Luigi Illica and Giuseppe Giacosa. Now, in the accelerated world of opera, they're now in love, and we are poised for the inevitable duet. But here again, Puccini's sense of theatrical timing realizes we need just a little break here. And so he brings the housemates back for a few seconds of clowning, and then, and only then, do we get our duet. And what a duet. This is the music that will be associated with their love for the remainder of the opera. Let's hear it right now. Could we hear example one, please? That's worth the price of admission all by itself, isn't it? All right, so we saw Act One, half comic, half serious. Notice that's balanced by Act Four, half comic, half serious. Notice the two interior acts also balance each other. Act Two, wholly comic. Act Three, wholly serious. Here again, the more you look, the more there is to see. Now, as I just mentioned, Act Two, light and comic, and I want you to notice that Puccini begins and ends the act with street scenes, and by so doing has very cleverly made Paris a living, breathing character in our story. Our housemates have come in some money, and so they're out on the town, part of the bohemian mythology, live for the moment, never a care for the future. As they're seated in the cafe, our painter Marcello's ex-girlfriend, Musetta, shows up. Now, she is the quintessential good time girl, and she has her latest sugar daddy in tow. It's also clear she's sick of him, and so she launches into this rather risque aria, both to upset the old boy and to regain Marcello's attentions. The opening line tells us the whole story of her aria. When I walk down the street, people stop and stare because I'm looking so good. Or put another way, I know I'm hot, they know I'm hot, they know I'm hot. This is another Puccini showstopper, and it's in two distinct sections, which I will identify for you as we listen to example two, please. By the way, this is a bit of recycled music here. Puccini had originally written this to commemorate, of all things, the launching of a battleship. Now, as the curtain goes up for Act Three, I want you to notice the great atmospheric music. The snow, the cold, harbingers of impending sorrows, for our lovers, and indeed, for Rodolfo and Mimi, that first intoxication of love has yielded to something much darker. It's clear that Mimi is desperately ill, and the impoverished Rodolfo cannot provide for her care. The harsh realities of life are closing in on our Bohemians. And by the way, if you are puzzled by Rodolfo's extreme jealousy at the beginning of this act, you're not alone. In 1957, a full copy of the libretto was discovered, revealing that there were actually five acts instead of four. Puccini cut one of them, presumably to tighten up the story, or maybe just to finish ahead of Leoncavallo, we don't know. But the missing act would have explained Rodolfo's jealousy. Now, before talking about the end, I have to issue a spoiler alert here. Remember, in the world of opera, when somebody coughs in Act One, you can already start their funeral arrangements. But joking aside, for me, the end of Bohème is among the most moving in all of opera. It's poignant, it's powerful, and here again, it's multi-layered. On the surface, we have the tragedy of Mimi's death. But underneath that surface, we have a whole constellation of shattered delusions. The delusions of youth, that poverty is somehow romantic, that we can create our own realities, or that art and love can sustain us. As Rodolfo will say, non basta amor, love is not enough. Mimi's final music is another Puccini miracle, achieving the maximum emotional effect with the simplest of musical means. It's built over a simple descending scale. Let's hear that right now. Could we hear example 3, please? And now, let's hear the aria built over that descending scale. Could we hear example 4, please? And this is a music that will bring down the final curtain. The miracle of La Boheme is that somehow these unassuming vignettes take on a surprising power by pouring great sorrows into humble souls. Puccini has given this story a universality and, I think, a resonance for all of us. We all have aspirations. We all have dreams. We all yearn for love. And these very things that sustain us are all too often the same things that break our hearts. In my view, no work has better captured that essential truth than La Boheme. Once again, my name is Robert Hartwell. Thank you so much for joining me. Please enjoy the show.